and welcome to another episode of Podcast DX, the show that brings you interviews with people just like you whose lives were forever changed by a medical diagnosis. I'm Lita.
I'm Ron the Budinsky.
And Jean is not with us today. Unfortunately, she's got a migraine. Collectively, we are the hosts of Podcast DX. On today's show, we are speaking with Sarah McDonald. Sarah is a two-time cancer survivor and one-time mother of daughter Rory, who's 6 and a half, we just found out. Good age. She has spent the majority of her 30-year career in the technology industry, 14 of years of which were at eBay, including the period while she was battling cancer. Sarah received her MBA from Cornell University and her BA from Occidental College. Beyond cancer, Sarah is interested in all things people-related, especially when paired with food, wine, the outdoors, and/or music. Sarah lives in Mill Valley, California, with her husband, Jeff, and daughter, Rory. The Cancer Channel is her first book. Thank you for joining our show today, Sarah.
Oh, my goodness. I'm thrilled to be here. Thank you so much.
Yeah, this is awesome. Thanks.
Sarah, to help put things in context, could you tell us about your life before you were diagnosed with cancer?
I sure can. I grew up in California, though moved to the East Coast for about 12 years, during which time I lived in New York City, I lived up in Boston, and I got my MBA from Cornell. That was awesome, but I did want to get back to California. So I came back to California and got a job at eBay. And that brings you up to speed to when the events of the book took place.
Okay, thank you very much.
Yeah. Sarah, were there any symptoms or anything that led you to your first cancer diagnosis?
Yeah. So as I said, I had been working at eBay for about 8 years and had just been promoted into the chief of staff to the president at eBay, and I was really excited about that job, that promotion. And I was at the dentist's, just getting a normal teeth cleaning. And about a week later, a week after my dentist trip, I noticed a lump in the floor of my mouth. Mm-hmm. And of course, I thought, wow, that was a really enthusiastic teeth cleaning. Uh-huh. And I must have gotten poked and I must have an infection. So I went back to the dentist and she said, you know, Sarah, there's a spectrum of things this could be. On one side, it could be an infection and we'll get you some antibiotics. On the other side of the spectrum, there's this really, really rare form of cancer, but I'm sure that's not it. Oh. And so spoiler alert, of course, that's exactly what it was.
Wow. That's terrible.
Yeah.
And I understand that you had a bit of a challenge getting the necessary testing to help diagnose your condition.
What's challenging is, of course, doctors and medical centers book out weeks and months in advance. So my dentist referred me to a specialist, and it just took me a long time and several trips to see him. Eventually, he had me order an MRI, but of course, my local medical center, it was going to be 6 weeks. So I ended up finding another one. And then I was referred to another specialist, and it was going to be another 6 weeks to see him, blah, blah, blah. It just was really, really challenging to get in and get MRIs and see the specialists necessary to diagnose what this was, what this lump was.
How big was the lump at that point?
It actually wasn't that big, and apparently had been there for a while.
Oh.
So this particular kind of cancer is called adenoid cystic carcinoma, which is a fancy word for salivary gland cancer, which of course you've never heard of because like nobody gets it, right?
Right.
1,200 people a year get salivary gland cancer. So super rare. And it's super slow growing, or at least mine was. So when it eventually was biopsied and excised, when it was cut out of me, uh-huh. They said, yeah, you have a really slow growing one. And it was probably there for months or a year. And it's kind of amazing to me that I never noticed it.
Yeah, for sure. Of course, if it's under your tongue, Maybe it's not something
how
that
often?
Gets brushed or whatever, right?
And how often are you actually are you actually
lifting,
you know,
your tongue
your
up
tongue
and looking.
Under your tongue?
Right, right. And how did self-advocacy help you to get the test that you needed done more, you know, on a more prompt manner?
Yeah, I believe in parallel processing all things, or being as efficient as I can be. So when things happened, like, hey, Sarah, we're not going to be able to give you an MRI for 6 weeks. That's when I looked for other MRI centers. And I actually flew down to Southern California to visit my family and went to an MRI center that was near them, and then had those tests sent to me. But I was, outside of those, I was also just super, super persistent. I like to think pleasantly persistent, but I was calling the doctors, and if they said, hey, it's going to be 6 weeks, I said, well, you know, can I be on a waiting list? Could I come in next week? Could I just come sit in the office so that the doctor can see me?
Right.
So I just really had to be pretty pushy and say, no, this is a priority. In fact, I said to one nurse, I'd love to tell you this isn't a matter of life and death, but I think it is. So I'm going to keep coming back until you see me.
Okay. Well, good for you.
Good.
I mean, more people have to have that kind of an attitude. And it's a shame, because we're talking about cancer, and the sooner they take care of it, the less complicated or difficult or possibly deadly it can be. So I guess we need more cancer doctors out there, huh?
Well, I think what's tough is when you get a cancer diagnosis, you're right, it's complicated, especially emotionally. It's
right.
Emotionally complicated.
Sure.
And, you know, many people are thrown into the you know, what is it, the five stages of grief, one of which is denial. So some people, and I had a bit of that myself, where one of the doctors said, I think this might be a malignancy. And I thought, he can't be right. There's no way at age 44, I have cancer. There's just no way.
Mm-hmm.
So you do go through the various stages, and it's hard. It's hard to know how you're going to react until you're in the situation, Lita.
Sure. I'm sure. Absolutely.
So Sarah, you mentioned that this type of cancer is kind of rare. Could you tell us about the diagnosis and perhaps why healthcare providers all need to take a class, you know, something on diagnosis, empathy, which is huge, and also humanity, and basically how not to give someone vital health information over the phone?
Oh, that's a teaser.
Yeah.
That's a teaser,
yeah.
Ron.
it was a nice setup, Ron. Thank you.
Yeah.
So after chasing down various doctors and various biopsies and tests and scans, blah, blah, I received a phone call at work from a specialist who said, Sarah, I know when I saw you last week, I told you that it wasn't cancer, but it is. The biopsy came back and you have cancer. And of course, I'm sitting at my desk at work, and I, you know, got up and walked into a conference room and said, you know, can you tell me what kind of cancer it is? And can you spell that for me? And as I started asking him questions, he became kind of defensive. He said, well, I'm not an expert in this. And I said, well, gosh, who is? And he said, well, I can write, you know, I'm asking him, you know, what is the prognosis? Like, you know, what are the statistics?
Right.
Am I going to survive this? And he said, we don't know that prior to the surgery. And then, you know, really looking at this cancer. And I said, great, can we do the surgery this week? And he said, like, I'm not the person to do the surgery, as if I would know that.
Wow.
And I said, well, can we get on the phone the person who could? And he said, you know, I'll write you a letter of recommendation.
Oh.
And I was like, I'm sorry, what? You're going to write me a letter of recommendation? And he said, yes. And then as I asked him, you know, pressed him on the statistics around this cancer, you know, he said, well, it's so rare. We just don't have a lot of data.
Oh, okay.
And he said, after 5 years, approximately 80% of people are still alive. And after 10 years, it drops down to about 30%. And he said, but I don't know, maybe it's different now. Maybe there's been more research.
Wow.
And I said,
wow.
Well, where are you getting this information? And
yeah.
He's like, on the internet. And you know, so I was like, is that where I'm supposed to find the information? And he said, you know, you're a smart girl. You'll figure it out.
Oh my God.
So that was, it was unfortunate.
Yeah.
It was unfortunate.
Yeah.
I have nicknamed him something I cannot say over the air.
I understand. He deserved that title.
That is a lesson in how not to talk to a patient.
Right.
Unbelievable.
Right.
Well, sorry to hear that.
It's okay. Thankfully, in balance, I had another cancer diagnosis 2 months later, and they were lovely.
Oh.
They were lovely when they gave me that cancer diagnosis.
Well, I'm sorry you had to go through it the first time to know that the second time was better. But
yeah, yeah. Well, it was a lesson in contrasts, right?
Right.
But I mean, super, you know, and I can say this now that I'm on the other side, super fascinating. And I do like to share the story.
Mm-hmm.
I have a number of friends who are doctors. So I like to share the story because it is kind of instructional and stark. So if you're okay, I'd love to tell about the second cancer diagnosis.
Yes. Oh, definitely. Definitely.
Since I've already set it up. So I did have surgery for the salivary gland cancer and they removed it. And about 2 weeks later, I was meeting with my head and neck surgeon talking about the further cancer treatments I would do. And he said, you know, we're going to do radiation. And my husband, Jeff, and I had come to the meeting with a huge list of questions. You probably are already getting a sense that I am someone who has curiosity about things like this. So we came with this list of questions. And I said to my doctor, you know, about 6 years ago, I found a lump in my breast and I had a mammogram and they found some calcifications. They did a biopsy and they told me I didn't have breast cancer. I said, but I'm just wondering, since I've now had this cancer diagnosis, is it worth revisiting? Is it possible that they were looking for breast cancer? And actually what it was metastatic adenoid cystic carcinoma. Is it possible that my salivary gland cancer had traveled to the breast?
Yeah,
and it was in two locations. And he said, Sarah, adenoid cystic carcinoma, when it metastasizes, likes to go to your lungs, your brain, which of course I loved hearing that.
Yeah.
Lungs or brain, super. And he said, Sarah, it doesn't go to your breast.
Okay.
And we almost never see it. And he said, so if you have cancer in your breast, then it is likely a separate primary source cancer.
Hmm.
And he said, Sarah, frankly, we just never see it in someone so young. But if it'll make you feel better, you should pursue it with your OBGYN.
Okay.
So of course I did. And I felt kind of sheepish, like I was a bit of a hypochondriac. But again, with this idea of being a self-advocate, you know, advocating for myself, I went back to the OBGYN and I said, hey, can we take a look at this lump? And she said, wow, is that getting bigger? And I said, you know, I haven't noticed it. And it haven't noticed it getting bigger. And she said, aren't you doing mammograms every year for this? And I said, yeah, I've been doing them for the last 6 years. And she said, huh, you know, you have really dense breasts. And sometimes tumors don't show up in mammograms with women who have dense breasts.
Right.
And you could have knocked me over with a feather. I thought, oh my goodness, why have we not pursued this before? And I said to her, well, remember they biopsied, they took a chunk out of the lump. Do you remember that? And she said, yeah, I see that. And I said, yeah, here's the scar from the biopsy. And she said, Sarah, look where the scar is and look where your lump is. They're not near one another.
Oh.
And guys, that was the first time I had noticed that.
Okay.
And this was my body.
Right,
right.
Right.
But I wanted so much to believe that I didn't have breast cancer, that I hadn't noticed,
okay,
that they probably hadn't biopsied the lump. And in fact, that was what had happened. They had actually biopsied clean flesh, you know, disease-free flesh instead of the tumor.
Oh, wow.
So of course, my OBGYN said, let's get you in for an MRI. And the MRI led to a biopsy. And they said, unfortunately, you have stage 3 breast cancer.
Oh,
wow.
Boy, oh boy. So how's your mental health? I don't know if I'm going to be asking this in the future, but my mental health just took a hit. How is your mental health since all of this happened?
Well, I do need to tell you, with the first cancer diagnosis, I felt, especially because, you know, one of the things they said to me is, like, it's not aggressive cancer, adenoid cystic carcinoma, the version I had. They said, but it is relentless and it's incurable. We have no known cure for adenoid cystic carcinoma.
Wow.
And I really have come to hate the word relentless, but it's what it is. It just keeps coming back and keeps coming.
I see. Okay.
And so my mental health, I was suffering. I was in fight or flight. 20, you know, for every hour of the day that I was awake, and given how much trouble I was having sleeping, it was a lot of hours of the day. I was in fight or flight. And then when I received the second cancer diagnosis, I thought, goodness, I'm not sure I'm going to make it through the year. Because while we found the adenoid cystic carcinoma relatively quickly, I mean, it was still a small lump.
Right.
I obviously knew that I had had the breast cancer tumor for at least 6 years, but from when I became aware of it. And I thought, that is not early stage.
Right.
So, so I wasn't sure what the year was going to hold. And so you can imagine it threw me into greater, depths of sadness and, you know, all those stages of grief we were talking about. So I went to my breast oncologist and I said, I know we've just met, but I am really suffering mentally and emotionally. I'm not sleeping. I'm not eating. I would like to ask that you prescribe an anti-anxiety medication for me, because I'm not sure that I won't die from a heart attack before one of these two cancers has a chance to kill me.
Right.
I really need some help. And she did prescribe something, and, you know, just low dose, but it helped to take the edge off.
Okay.
And then I also started pursuing yoga and meditation and started doing some energy work and acupuncture and all of these kind of Eastern practices to try to get on top of it. And the combination of the anti-anxiety medication plus the, I mean, I was a student in these practices. I was leaning in hard. The combination of the two, I was able to relax and kind of accept my diagnosis. And then I became very, very focused on just how can I heal the best I can? How can I ensure my body is receptive to the medication? And thankfully, my body did everything it needed to do. And by the end of the year, I was no evidence of disease for the salivary gland cancer and no evidence of disease for the breast cancer.
Okay, good.
Oh, that's fantastic.
That's a good answer. I like it when it ends on a positive note. How did your healthcare team choose to treat the breast cancer?
So I was being treated at Stanford, which I cannot highly recommend enough. They were unbelievable, and they cared about the whole person. There was never a doctor's meeting that I didn't go to where they didn't ask how I was doing emotionally and mentally and physically. It was, I felt very cared for as a whole person.
That's good.
But the protocol that they followed was a protocol for my specific kind of cancer that came out of MD Anderson in Houston. And we started with chemo. And I did 6 months of chemo, Taxol first, and then AC, which I think is erythromycin, but I might be getting that word wrong because I am not a doctor. But it was AC. They call it the red devil because the chemo is red.
Okay.
But I did about 6 months of chemo. Then I had two breast surgeries, a second breast surgery because they didn't achieve clean margins the first time. And then once they felt they had achieved clean margins, I did 6 weeks of radiation to the breast.
Wow.
But you'll remember, there were two cancers. So I actually had concurrent treatment. So the way things went down, I started out with the surgery for the salivary gland cancer. And I did 6 weeks of radiation for the salivary gland cancer when we began the chemo for the breast cancer. So I was concurrently doing chemo and radiation. And I would say, kids, don't try this at home. It's turns out that chemo intensifies radiation.
Oh.
So after 2 weeks of radiation and 2 weeks of chemo, my mouth started showing the toxicity that the technicians and doctors normally saw kind of at 6 weeks of radiation. So I was already having bleeding in my mouth and was starting to have sores. And so kind of at the apex, I had about 21 sores in my mouth. It was like my mouth was sunburned. And there was probably a good 3 to 4 week period where I could not eat. Oh. there was just no way. I was drinking Ensure to keep up my strength, right. But I had zero interest in food, which, you know, as a woman who has struggled with her weight her entire life, you know,
it was okay for a couple
weight loss
weeks.
Was
yeah.
great.
Yeah.
but not
lining, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. But definitely nothing I would ever want, wish on anyone, nor anything I would ever want to go through again.
Amen.
Wow. Yeah. So I have a couple of questions to ask, but I kind of want to backtrack a little bit. You were still working when you got the first cancer diagnosis, correct?
I sure was.
You mentioned you got the call at work. And then were you still working when you got the second one?
So, you know, it's really interesting. With the first cancer diagnosis, I went through a reaction that I think is common for a lot of people, which is this embarrassment that I had cancer, and kind of a belief, was there something I had done? And I didn't want people to know that I had it. I wanted to be very private. I hoped to go through all the cancer treatments and kind of as quickly as I could put it behind me and get back to my fabulous life. Cause I felt, you know, I was loving my life. So I told them at work at eBay, I said, I'm going to be gone for like 2 weeks. It'll just be like a vacation. And then I'm coming back and I'm going to do radiation while I continue to work full time. And they said, you know, this is the president of eBay and the head of HR for eBay. They said, you don't need to do that. You know, you can take the time. And I said, no, I really want to continue to work. But so I was sending emails, et cetera, et cetera. But then once we started looking into the breast cancer and I received the second breast cancer diagnosis, I called the head of HR. She was my first phone call after my husband. Mm-hmm. I called and said, I now have a second cancer diagnosis and kind of all bets are off. I need to go on short-term disability, possibly long-term disability.
Right.
And the head of HR said, and I'm turning off your email. She was terrific. She was like, Sarah, it is time for you simply to focus on healing.
Right.
And I am forever grateful. She was right. And with the second cancer diagnosis, I stopped being embarrassed and feeling like I needed to be private. I recognized that I might not survive the year. So I became very focused on how could I go through the end of my life as gracefully as I could. And at that point, I did want everyone that I knew and loved to know that I was going through it. And I started a blog on CaringBridge, which allowed me to keep everyone up to speed. Work colleagues were on this blog, as well as friends and family. So I could keep everyone up to speed with what was going on with my health. And it was tremendous.
That's great. I mean, to have that kind of support behind you, did you ever go back to work or did you retire?
I did.
Okay.
I did go back to work. You can imagine when your company is as supportive as eBay was. And to be clear, companies are made of people. So it's humans making the decision to be human with other humans,
right.
to be caring and giving and gracious and kind to other humans. And I have to say that was my experience during my 14 years at eBay. So this was at the 8-year mark. And I came back and worked there for 6 more years out of loyalty and gratitude, but also because I was a disciple of eBay. I really believed in what eBay was trying to do, which was to enable economic opportunity for all. And I still remain a huge eBay fan, but they were tremendous. And I always like to tell people they were not just tremendous to me because I was the chief of staff. They were tremendous to me because I was an employee. And I know of other employees who had similar beautiful experiences with that company. And so a lot of what I'm doing these days is talking at corporations about how managers can show up for their employees who are in crisis, or how companies can support their employees in crisis. And if I could also say, this really super cool thing just happened at Davos at the World Economic Forum. And I don't know if you guys have been following it, but the CEO of Publicis, which is an advertising company in Europe, his name is Arthur Sadoun. And I don't know if I'm pronouncing his last name, Sadoun, correctly, but he's just been diagnosed with cancer and has come public with his treatments. And at Davos, he asked over 200 other CEOs to sign a pledge called the hashtag Working with Cancer Pledge, which asks companies to commit to creating supportive working environments for their employees who are living with cancer. And oh my goodness, how amazing is that? I'm sorry it took Arthur getting cancer to develop that sensibility, but how tremendous that he has chosen to take his, you know, his platform and speak to how we, because so often cancer is still spoken of in hushed tones, like she has cancer.
Yeah.
Right. Instead of saying, hey, I hear you have cancer. I am so sorry you're going through that.
Right.
It must be so hard. And that's all we need to say to people, anyone in crisis. I am so sorry you're going through this. It must be hard.
The people touch.
Yeah. Excellent advice. Ironically, that kind of leads me into the next question I was going to ask. Based on your experience, and I probably just answered that, what should someone do who's just recently been diagnosed with cancer?
So I wrote a book called The Cancer Channel, and I also created a website called thecancerchannelbook.com. And there I have a list of 10 things someone newly diagnosed with cancer can do, 10 things you can do for someone you love who's been newly diagnosed. And then the third kind of tool or list is 5 things not to say to someone with cancer and a suggestion for other things you can say. But I would say the single most important thing for someone who has been newly diagnosed is, number one, to understand your diagnosis. And that means asking a lot of questions. And that might include going and getting a second diagnosis. Mm-hmm. And I know for some people that seems disrespectful of the first doctor. And I have to tell you, well, I had cancer. My dad had been diagnosed with cancer 10 years earlier, and his cancer had a recurrence while I had my cancer. And one of the things I suggested to my dad is, hey, dad, go get a second diagnosis. And oh gosh, you're being treated for a heart condition. Do you know how your medications interact? Have you talked to the doctors about that? And my dad felt like I was being really disrespectful to him and to his doctors.
Oh.
And so that was tough, but I remain convinced that doctors are human.
Right, right.
And certainly my misdiagnosis is evidence that doctors make mistakes sometimes. And I don't think anybody does that on purpose, but they make mistakes. And so I think it's worth going and asking someone else or someone's else. Maybe you get three diagnoses.
Right.
Just go ask, you know, what do you think this is? How do you think we can best treat it? And then work with the doctor with whom you feel most comfortable.
Right.
Like I think back to that original guy who diagnosed me and what
he won't
you know,
be
bad word.
Right, right.
He was like, that would have been awful if I had to work with him. I didn't trust him. I didn't like him. And the doctors I did work with at Stanford were tremendous, tremendous bedside manner. So and they're smarty pants over there, it turns out. So first thing is understand your diagnosis. Number two is get a second opinion. Number three is, gather your people around you and determine who your support system is going to be, because you'll need it mentally, emotionally, and physically. Cancer treatment can be arduous. It can be hard and it can be tiring. And so grabbing somebody else who can drive you to and from meetings or can sit in the meeting with you and take notes, because it turns out when you're sitting in a room talking about your mortality, there's a lot of adrenaline pumping through your body.
You don't hear a word they're saying, right?
Yeah, and you just can't hear everything. You can't. I was amazed. Jeff was the one taking notes when we would meet with the doctor. I would ask the questions. Jeff would take the notes.
Right.
And afterward, I would read his notes, and there were things I didn't hear the doctor say. It was amazing. So, so gather your support. And then I do think, take a look at your mental health. And there is no shame, I feel, in asking for help, whether it be, a therapist or medication to help you through it, because this is serious stuff.
Right.
This is serious stuff. So those are some of the pieces of advice, but I think probably the three or four most important pieces.
Good advice.
Okay. Yeah. I mean, I think that's great advice, because although obviously you're the one diagnosed with it, it does affect your family, your friends, everybody. And we've talked about this many, many times on this show. It's having a support system, family, friends that you can rely on and to be your rock.
Yeah. Yeah. And occasionally you're the rock for them. I advise people to focus first on taking care of themselves, make sure that you are mentally and physically being taken care of. But it is surprising how many loved ones will come and say, I need you to help me with this. And, I would always say to people, I had a really good girlfriend say to me, I need you to tell me you're going to be okay. And I said, sweetheart, I can't tell you that. And I'm going to be super open and honest and transparent in all of the blogs that I send out. And I would love to see you and hug you, but I can't take care of you right now.
Right.
You have to figure that out. I have to take care of me. And I was just really open and honest about that. But it does, I tell people who have cancer, I was like, the people who are nearest and dearest to you are mm-hmm. going to go through the same, grief that you do, the same, it might not mirror your grief and it might not be as intense, or in some cases it may be more intense because people are afraid of being left behind. Like, oh my God, what if you do die? What will I do without you in my life? These are existential crisis moments, but for somebody who is in the health crisis, you need to take care of yourself first. That's what my strong point of view, that would be my advice to you.
And it's excellent advice. Excellent. Thank you so much. Lita, I don't want to go into this next one, Why don't you talk about it? About our new endeavor.
Oh, okay.
I'm enthralled with Sarah and
all right,
your conversation.
All right. Well, now
we hear stuff a lot.
Yes, we do.
And you know, everybody's got their story, and we understand that. But hearing yours, the first diagnosis, that's always the worst. The first time you hear a doctor say you have cancer, it's like everything stops. Everything stands still for a minute until you can refocus. And then you move on and you try to figure out how to live life and what you're going to do about it. And then, like you said, with the second diagnosis and everything that came, as we get older, and I'm kind of freestyling, I guess, we all, I think about our mortality. But then when you hear something aggressive that a doctor, you know, mentions to you, I think it kind of amplifies that. And then you kind of look back and reevaluate things. But listening to your story has just been absolutely amazing.
Oh, thank you so much, Ron. Yeah, and I had this great opportunity. I decided to write a book. And the reason I decided to write it is I was ending up talking to so many people who were newly diagnosed. I didn't set out to write a memoir. I'm not famous or infamous yet, but I'm neither famous nor infamous, but I had a kind of a wild story that included, you know, there's a whole fertility journey. There are two cancer diagnoses. There's my dad getting, yeah, you know, having his cancer come back. And so I wrote a memoir of this time called the Cancer Channel. And the Cancer Channel refers to, you know, when you first get that cancer diagnosis, somewhere in your brain, a switch goes on, and it's the Cancer Channel, which plays all cancer all the time. And all you're thinking is, oh my God, I have cancer. Oh my God, I have cancer. Oh my God, I have cancer. So my book is kind of an exploration of the lived experience of a cancer patient and how I went through all these things and emerged on the other side. I try to be very open and honest and visceral in my descriptions of what it's like to be treated for cancer and what it's like to deal with it emotionally, but I also laugh at it. So I make fun of it. And some of the ridiculous things your body, the physical indignities of cancer treatment. And anyway, I wrote it for people who have cancer, but also for the loved ones of people who have cancer. And of course, the crazy thing we know is the American Cancer Society says 1 in 3 women will be diagnosed with cancer in her lifetime, and 1 in 2 men, Ron. 1 in 2 men. So if you're not the person with cancer, likely you know someone. Yeah. So that was the goal of the book. And I think if your listeners are enjoying hearing some of this, I would, you know, encourage them to look for the Cancer Channel. You can get it on Amazon, but you can also actually go to your local bookstore and order it with them. They're probably not carrying it yet, but they can go to their local bookstore.
All right. Well, we're going to definitely put a link on our website.
Fantastic. Both Lita and I are recreation therapists. So, you know, when you talk about the way you confront it, I mean, your mental health is the biggest thing right there. And it's the way you view it. And it's not like you don't take it serious, but you have to find a way to, what am I looking to say?
To live understand, through it mentally.
Yeah.
Yeah, understand and to, what's
and
going
to,
on.
And to be prepared for the battle. It's not just, you're not going to go through it as a bystander. You're going to go through it as the victor.
Right. And just, you know, I focused on how can I be peaceful and graceful and intentional? And I went head into every time they said, well, we could, you know, be mild in the treatment or we can go really aggressively. And I said, as aggressive as my body can withstand, I don't want it coming back. Let's kill this. And I said, and I will handle the pain, But it is as much a mental journey or a mental battle as it is physical, or at least it was for me. And I, you know, I was dedicated to trying to calm my brain so that it could calm my body.
Very good. Good.
That's excellent
that's
advice.
A, that's a good war plan that you came up with.
Thank you.
Now that we've discussed the basics of this topic, our listeners have a better understanding of it. I think it's a good time to remind everybody of our new endeavor. To better serve our guest and listening audience, we are now working as an affiliate with a major medical supply warehouse in the United States, and you'll be able to find affiliate links on our website. Jack, edit that out. It was not an affiliate leak. And learn more about this in future episodes. But now let's get back to our show. Sarah, what role has fitness and nutrition played in your recovery?
You know, when I was first diagnosed, I said to my doctor, like, was it something I ate? Or what would you recommend that I do? And he said, Sarah, just eat real food. Do not eat processed food. Right. And my husband and I do not eat a lot of processed food. I happen to love to cook. So we really, really focus on fresh produce. But I have, in more recent years, I was helping to advise a startup about a year or so ago that was trying to help cancer patients adopt a ketogenic diet.
Okay.
And I have since adopted a, you know, kind of a hybrid ketogenic diet, or a certainly low carb. So in a ketogenic diet, you remove all sugar and carbs, or you work to as best you can remove all sugar and carbs, because cancer cells are not very flexible. They really can only feed on glucose and sugar, is my understanding. And so I focus on, you know, vegetables and protein and fats that your healthy cells can eat. And so, you know, adopting this diet effectively feeds your healthy cells
and
tries to starve your cancer cells so that any treatment you get is more effective. So that's what the startup was trying to help cancer patients do. And as I say, I was advising them. And in doing so, I said, you know, let me adopt the ketogenic diet in order to see what the challenges are for people adopting a ketogenic diet. And I was like, wow, I really prefer this. I feel better.
Okay.
I don't currently have cancer, knock wood, no evidence of disease, but I feel like should it come back, I will absolutely go strict keto in order to best fight it.
Okay.
That's interesting. That's good to know. And here I was using keto to lose weight.
And then you asked about fitness,
right.
And I am somebody who enjoys working out. And actually, during my year of cancer, I was running almost every day. I was in some of the best shape of my life.
Wow!
In part because I wasn't working, I had the time, so I just dedicated myself to running and lifting weights, and I was doing a ton of yoga, which, you know, was also helped with my muscles. And I just felt that the better physical shape I was in, the better my body was going to be able to fight. And it was just, it was true. It worked for me.
You have a good protocol there.
Yeah.
Yeah. That's fantastic. Yeah.
I am now working again. You know, I did go back to work and I'm working for another startup now. And that takes a lot of time, but I do try to work out, you know, 3 to 4 times a week on my, I'm now a disciple of Peloton.
Oh, I've heard of them. Yes.
And they, oh my goodness. And they have all sorts of different kinds of classes, and I will shut up now because I can talk a lot about Peloton.
Okay.
And how much I love it.
Okay.
Here's your shameless plug, right?
my shameless plug. Yes.
So Sarah, how has your wry sense of humor helped you and your family through all of this?
You know, when you're going through something, it's gallows humor, right? It's gallows humor. When you're going through all of this, you do need to be able to maintain your sense of humor or point out the ridiculous to one another so you can get a break. So I certainly, in my blog that I kept during the year of cancer, I tried to make it as funny and engaging as it could be, so that people came back and read it, frankly. And in fact, one of the things I did in my blog is I set up metrics. So my background is business, and I tend to work in operations at various companies. And so I set metrics for my cancer treatment. And every week in my blog, I would share with people how I was progressing in my metrics and whether I was meeting or exceeding my metrics. And at the end of my year of cancer, I then declared in my blog that I had exceeded all metrics. And I called out my husband and said, I thought that I had won the President's Club trip to Mexico. And so I demanded that he take me to Mexico. And we went to Puna Mita, which is just outside Puerto Vallarta. And it was stunning. We went there for a week just to celebrate cancer being over, knock wood. And, but yeah, you have to have a sense of humor, about life's ridiculousness.
Right.
And it helps make you more graceful as you go through it.
Okay. Good deal.
Absolutely. And this is more of a serious question. What are some of the less obvious parts of your life that have been affected by your experience with cancer?
Yeah, I think that I live differently. You're saying less obvious. I think this is obvious stuff, which is just, I knew people were important, that the people in my, I'm an extrovert and I am very lucky to have many, many close friends. And what I found during the year of cancer, that when I thought I only had a year to live, that what became most important was having people, those people I loved around me. And what was fascinating to me is there were a lot of friendships that deepened during that year. I had time to focus and concentrate and be present for those relationships. I think another, just in the vein of human relationships, you know, when I was younger, my mom told me, you know, you really won't meet close friends after the age of 30. Like, you know, your close friends are really made growing up and in college and in your early 20s. And mom has been right on some things. On this, she has been very wrong. For me, I have met, even within the last year, I have met some super, super close friends. And I think in part, it's because I show up so intently or intentionally and am able to really lean into those relationships. I think another fascinating thing that I guess I wouldn't have known is I'm not afraid to talk about death now, and I'm not afraid to talk about dying, and I'm not afraid to cry in front of people I don't know, or just talk about those really, really difficult things. I think in part because I've seen it and I've been there. So I'm now able to, it has made me a different executive. At my last startup where I was COO of the company, HR actually reported into me. And I was COO at this company when we were going through the pandemic, when the pandemic launched, and on kind of a weekly basis, I was speaking to the whole company about their mental health and about their importance of taking care of themselves and their family. And just those topics aren't frightening. They're not third rail topics for me. And in fact, in part, that's why I was telling you about the hashtag working with cancer pledge. Right. I think it's so fantastic to have executives committing to talk about these really difficult things with their employees, because guess what? It's going to happen. You will have employees who die. You will have employees who have life-threatening, you know, diseases or just other kinds of crisis.
Right.
And what you need to do is lean in and talk openly about it and give as much support as you can. So I'm very committed to those types of things now. I don't know that I wasn't before, but I'm more dedicated to it. I'm more convinced, and I want to add my voice to the conversation.
All right.
I think you're doing a great job.
Yeah, for sure.
Thank you.
And it's pretty obvious that you have gotten support from friends and family. Who would get the biggest shout out from you? Who helped you the most?
Yeah. So certainly my husband gets a huge shout out. He was unbelievable. And we were kind of on the same page the whole time. You know, we talked very openly and honestly about what was going on. And he didn't, he was just patient. And just, as I say in the book, he just kept showing up. He just, he was just by my side and he took his cues from me. I also have to shout out one of my very best friends, a woman named Tripti Mahendra. Tripti and I met at work, you know, I don't know, 30 years ago. And she left the corporate world and became a yoga instructor and is kind of in the wellness space now. And when I told her that I had been diagnosed with cancer and was telling her about my doctors at Stanford, she said, "You know, Sarah, you have some of the best Western medicine available. Lucky you. We're going to call them Team One. I'm going to be in charge of Team Two. And Team Two is going to be the Eastern practices that I shared with you." And, you know, she was the one. It was her yoga class and classes that I was going to. She was teaching me how to meditate. She was encouraging me to do energy work and acupuncture. And whereas Team One, the Western medicine, was healing my body, Team Two was healing my mind and my soul. So I have to call out Tripti. And if I have a second to call out two other people, Kristen Yetto, who was the head of HR at eBay, and Ruth Lati, who was a Dr. Ruth Lati, who was my fertility doctor. They were two of the first people I told about my cancer diagnosis. And for the next 2 to 4 weeks, they both texted me every day just to check in. And they showed me how to show up for somebody who has cancer. They were kind and gentle and caring. And I mean, you know, for Ruth, I was a patient. For Kristen, I was an employee, but both leaned in as humans, and they are both two indispensable friends now, who I actually dedicate the book to.
That's wonderful.
Yeah.
Thank you for sharing, which actually kind of goes into my next question. You touched on it earlier, but what inspired you to write the book, The Cancer Channel, 1 year, two cancers, three miracles? Again, I know you talked about it earlier. Can you kind of go over it again?
Yeah, there's a bigger story. So what I originally set out to do was write a guidebook for the newly diagnosed. So when I was first diagnosed, my parents are both academics. So I grew up in a family that if you didn't know something, you grabbed the dictionary or the encyclopedia, you know, which you'd now Google, right?
Right.
But I started trying to research cancer. I wanted to understand what had gone wrong. And the books that I found were written by doctors explaining why does cancer happen? What are the treatments and what are the side effects? And what I couldn't find was something describing the lived experience. So, and boy, I was overwhelmed by the language of cancer. I didn't know anything about it. So I was just trying to become facile or fluent in the language of cancer. So I started writing a guidebook to the newly diagnosed, which would outline kind of the language and what's happened, but also what does it feel like to get radiation? What does it feel like to get chemo? And so that was the book I wrote initially. And it took me a while because after my cancer treatments, I went back into my fabulous life. And so it took me a while to write the guidebook. But once I did, I didn't know anybody in the publishing industry. So I was contacting friends and family and saying, do you know anyone? And I ended up talking to about five people, all of whom said, guidebooks are written by doctors, not by patients. No one is going to read your guidebook, and we will not publish it.
Wow.
And I thought, God, I disagree with you. Yeah. I disagree.
Challenge accepted.
Yeah. but I just thought, you know, I you're right. I don't know anything about what people read. And to a person, they said, you know, you have a good, and I'm air quoting that nobody can see. I'm air quoting. You have a good voice. You're funny, right? So maybe what you should do is write a memoir. And as I said earlier, I am neither famous nor infamous. So it seemed arrogant and self-absorbed to write a memoir. And I am many things, but I hope I am not those. But I thought, gosh, if this could be helpful to people who are going through cancer, if this could be helpful to their friends and family, you know what? I'm writing the damn book. And so right. I wrote the memoir and then I self-published it. I developed my own imprint, Sarah E. McDonald Publishing, okay. Or I don't remember what I called it, but yeah. Developed my own imprint and I self-published. And you know, the reaction, the outpouring, the feedback has been unbelievably tremendous. I mean, and from both cancer patients as well as those who have never had cancer but have friends and family. And that has made it all worth it. It took me 10 years to write the book. I had three different editors. I had a lot of beta readers, and I just kept revising until I felt like it was good enough. And I reminded myself, perfection is the enemy of good enough. And eventually I said, you know, on the 10-year anniversary of my first cancer diagnosis, let's publish it. So I published it this last year.
Okay. What surprised you the most about blogging during your treatment and recovery?
I guess the reactions of people. I mean, people were eating it up, especially the metrics. Like, I did the metrics to be funny.
Right.
And my husband was like, oh my God, you're so weird. People are gonna hate the metrics. Quite the opposite. People were like, oh my God, I love this. You know, and again, it was the gallows humor.
Right.
Especially the business people are like, this is fantastic. You have a scorecard for your cancer. Huzzah, this is great. So that was the funny thing. If I can take your question and evolve it, I would like to say the funniest thing about writing the memoir, you know, you kind of get focused on, okay, I just need to get this thing published, right? And the day that I launched it, Jeff and I had a party to go to that night. And we went to the party and two of my friends came rushing in and they said, oh my God, we were late to the party because we can't set your book down.
Oh, wow.
And I was like, what? What? And that has been a lot of the reaction I've gotten from people. They're like, it is a page turner. I'm like, wait, you know the outcome. How can that be possible? Come on. Get over yourselves. But that's been the reaction. Like, wow, it's a page turner. I can't set it down. So that's been great. But I also had the realization. So Jeff and I came home from that party that night and all these people were like, you know, we downloaded the Kindle. We're reading your book tonight. And we sat on the couch and we're sharing a glass of wine. And I said, sweetie, there are all these friends of ours and people we don't know reading about our life. Oh my God. And I know that seems so obvious, but it just hadn't been obvious to me because I had become so focused on just getting it published. But there is something very, kind of amazing about being so public about something so private, right? And what has been amazing now is now I have people reaching out to me whom I've never met before. And the first thing out of their mouths is, I feel like you're my best friend.
Oh, wow.
And I'm thinking, great. We haven't even met.
Right, right.
We don't know each other. Thank you. But that's been the most surprising. People are like, I feel like you're my best friend because of your style of writing. And I'm doing an audiobook.
OK. Okay.
I'll be recording it. Okay. And I think that'll be really fascinating because it will be quite literally my voice.
Right.
So I'm fascinated to hear the reaction about that too.
All right. I'm looking forward to that out because I'll be listening to it. I absorb all of my reading through my ears nowadays.
So, Lita, so many people tell me that. So especially, like, people are so busy. So they multitask. They work out and listen to an audiobook, or they drive and listen to an audiobook. So I've had a number of friends say, you are one of my closest friends. I have no intention of reading your book until it's an audiobook. No intention. I'm like, okay, thanks for your honesty.
So Lita mentioned earlier, we're now working as an affiliate with a medical supply warehouse. Were there any supplies or medical equipment that you absolutely could not have done without, other than the Peloton? But was there something that, you know, seemed to work better than something else? I'm sure our audience would be interested in hearing.
Well, I have two items that I thought were fascinating. And I don't know if one of the medical devices that that your affiliated company sells is ports. I had never heard of a port before.
Oh, yeah.
Medical port.
Right.
Yeah, that they insert under your skin and hook into your veins.
Yep.
Like, I had knowledge of this totally rad device. And so I'm a child of the 80s, right? So things are totally rad in my lexicon. And I mean, I thought this port was the coolest thing, because you can then take blood, you can receive your chemo through the port rather than through your veins. And by the way, I have terrific veins. I have yet to go to a phlebotomist and not have them say, oh my goodness, you have the most beautiful veins. I'm like, I know, I hear that. But when you're getting chemo every week, guess what? That's going to get pretty tiresome for your veins.
Right.
So they said, we'd like to insert a port. And I was like, oh my, how fascinating. Yes, yes, yes. Let's do it. So I was amazed by this port. They inserted it in before we started doing chemo. And, you know, I didn't love the look of it when I was wearing a bikini, but it was just really super cool. So I would say, thumbs up for ports. The other thing that I didn't know, and maybe it's because I had never been with anyone to chemo, I didn't know that IV things were portable. Like, I didn't know that IVs were on wheels.
Uh-huh.
And so I really loved the fact that while I was, you know, sitting in a chair for 4 hours receiving chemo, that I could walk to the bathroom and continue to receive chemo. So that was that was amazing. And those might not be the two things that you were looking
for.
No,
that's okay.
We just want to hear your story.
Yes.
Yeah, I just have to call out. This was one of the things, like, I didn't have experience with cancer. So I was just learning all these new things. And I'm a big fan of, I have lots of curiosity. So it was, I hadn't ever even considered medicine as, I enjoyed my biology classes, the science classes I took. And my mom's a scientist, but I had never thought about medicine. And the human body is amazing. So maybe people are now listening and rolling their eyes like, Sarah, catch up. It's always been cool and amazing. But until I was in a health crisis, I had taken a lot for granted.
I think we all do.
Yeah. And didn't understand some of these things. So anyway, that was super cool.
Excellent.
No, thank you.
Yes. Thank you very much. I mean, when you think about it, people that go home, for therapies, and there are people that have therapies at home, those wheelie devices, they might be very good to have at home. Maybe the wheels have to be bigger because you might have carpeting. Yeah. But yeah, we could definitely look into that. Thank you for that advice.
Cool. Yeah, so
and
cool.
Thank you very much for joining our show today, Sarah. How can our listeners learn more about you and your journey? I already wrote down the website, but go ahead and give it to us again.
Great. So the website is called thecancerchannelbook.com. And on that website, you will find excerpts from the book. I am keeping a journal on the website. You'll find pictures from the year of cancer, and also media contact information if you'd like. And oh, I mentioned earlier the tools,
Right.
the 10 things to do if you receive a
Right.
cancer diagnosis,
Right.
et cetera. But yeah, I would love for, oh, and I'm creating a calendar of all of the TV interviews, radio spots, and podcasts that I've been doing
Oh,
so
nice.
that people can link to them and read to them. So
Nice.
that should be up in the next week or
Okay.
two. So I'll place this podcast there. But I would love it if people came to the website. They can also email me if they want to.
Okay.
They have the ability to do that from the website.
Great. Any social media links on there too?
I have all of my socials
Okay.
there, so I post a lot on LinkedIn,
Okay.
on Facebook, and I am new to the Instagram, and I am limited on the Twitter for other reasons. But yeah, so but you can follow all of those socials.
Okay.
And then as far as where you can get the book, as I mentioned, you can get it in paperback, hardcover, and Kindle on Amazon, or you can order it in paperback or hardcover from your local bookstore.
Okay, great. We will put links on our website for
Yeah.
you.
Super duper. Thank you so much. I really have appreciated this conversation. It's been a lot of fun.
Oh, good. I'm glad that you were
Oh,
here.
absolutely.
And if any of our listeners have any questions or comments related to today's show, they can contact us at podcastdx@yahoo.com, through our website, podcastdx.com, on Facebook, TikTok, Pinterest, or Instagram.
And if you have a moment to spare, please give us a review wherever you get your podcast. As always, please keep in mind that this podcast is not intended to be a substitute for professional medical advice, diagnosis, or treatment. Always seek the advice of your physician or other qualified healthcare provider with any questions you may have regarding a medical condition or treatment and before undertaking a new healthcare regime. And never disregard professional medical advice or delay in seeking it because of something you've heard on this podcast.
All right, folks, till next week, we'll see you again.